Hello and welcome to episode number 13 of Inglourious Artist with me, Peter Holland. This time I'm talking to up-and-coming film director Andreas Clement. And without further ado, this is my conversation with Andreas Clement. Andreas, welcome to my home.
Thank you. How close should I be to the microphone? Is this okay?
Sounds good, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think I introduced you as a up-and-coming director. How does that sound?
I think that sounds pretty fair, I guess.
All right. Because you, a couple of years back, you did your first feature film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Origin.
Yeah.
That was pretty quickly, wasn't it? You'd just done a couple of short films before that.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And then straight into the feature. How did that feel? And how did that planning go about? Because you, I mean, from somebody who doesn't know you very well, you seem like a very methodical person when it comes to how you view your career, let's say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I would say that's a fair assessment. Right. I guess what happened was... together with my, at the time, directing partner, André Hedetoft, we had made a bunch of short films. We started making short films that did fairly well online. So what happened was we were working on the short films. They started doing well online and at festivals and so on. And they started getting a bit of traction. Mm. And then getting to know more and more people in the film community. There was one guy in particular, a friend of mine named Antonio Tublén, who's also a director. And talking to Antonio about the film projects we were doing, he had just made a feature film called LFO that he shot in 10 days.
Yeah.
So
we talked about this film on the podcast before, actually.
Yeah, so the thing was basically, Antonio said to us, like, guys, you have made so many short films now. Mm. You know how to make films. I just made a film in 10 days. Why are you not looking at the possibility of making a feature film?
Ah.
So that's sort of what kicked off the idea of maybe we could make a feature film. Mm. Even though we, like, if Antonio hadn't said it, we would probably not have made a feature film that soon.
Right.
Yeah.
Because it's scary.
It is scary. I mean, it's a completely different process, a lot larger than making a short film. Even though a lot of the stuff is quite similar, it takes a lot more time. And let's just say I'm really glad that I didn't know how hard it would be when Antonio convinced us that we could make a feature film. Because we were just like, well, if Antonio can make a feature film in 10 days, then we could also make a feature film in 10 days. But it turned out we shot for 19 days instead. And it became larger, and the original script for the film would have taken maybe 4 weeks to shoot.
Yeah, and 19 days is still very fast.
Yeah, so that was sort of the, not really the cut down version of the film, but we had to minimize it a lot just to be able to shoot it. Because we just decided, what we have usually done on all of the films we have done, is to just decide to make a film. And decide, we're going to shoot this in 4 weeks or something. And then people can jump on the train and be part of it if they want to. But we have never let anything stop us. We have used quite a few collaborators who we are very tight with. And that collaboration becomes better and better with each time and each project. But with the short films, it has almost always been zero budget short films that we have always tried to make them feel as big as possible anyway.
Yeah, sure.
And in that case, it has just been about bringing people on board who wanted to be part of the project. So that's basically what we ended up doing on Origin also. Because we did think a lot about going about it the traditional way of getting traditional film financing and so on, which in Europe is usually you go to the film financing institutes and you get funding for your project. And we did have very positive meetings with the Swedish Film Institute about Origin. And like they really liked the script and the idea and so on. But they told us, you guys, we will probably give you funding, but you have to promise you're not going to shoot it this summer. And our plan was to shoot it that summer.
Well, why did they say that?
Because they probably felt that we needed to keep developing the script more.
Okay.
Yeah, so they were basically, they were saying, we could give you development funds, but you actually have to use the development funds to develop the script more. And not try to trick us and use the development funds to shoot the film.
Of course. Which everything has to be used for sometimes. The right... Yeah, okay.
Yeah. No, and I think, honestly, I think the people we were talking to, they felt that the project had a lot of promise, but that it could become even better. And to be fair, they were probably right. Because I directed Origin 3 years ago, and I have learned a lot since then. I'm really, really glad that I made a film, and I'm really glad I didn't know the challenges we were that we had ahead of us when we made it. Because I have grown so much as a filmmaker and as a person from jumping into the project and being able to take it from zero to finished.
Learning by doing.
Yeah, exactly. That's how I enjoy learning. But yeah, but if I had known all the challenges beforehand, no way would I have done it.
Right. Okay. So there's no regret doing it back then or doing it all at all?
Well, financially, I guess I would regret it slightly because it like we pretty much, we got a tiny bit of funding, but basically we funded the entire movie ourselves, at least for during production. Then we got a little bit of more financing during post-production to be able to finish it.
Okay.
But we ended up paying way more out of our own pocket than we, like, even more money than we actually had. So making your first feature film, maybe it was good that we didn't know that it would lead to economical trouble. That so you sort of like you dig yourself into a hole that you then have to dig yourself out of also. But we did end up with a finished movie that was pretty good, decent at least. And it did tour festivals and did quite well. We won awards at a few different festivals.
Yeah, well, then there you go. Because I think you would probably have to weigh the pros and cons, really, when it comes to doing this. Like, should I do something now so I learn and become better?
Yeah.
And then risk having the reputation of doing these crap films, if, if it turned out to be a crap film.
Yeah.
Or should I wait and then make my first perfect feature? And but it'll take 10 years
absolutely.
To do it. You know.
No, and I think that's an issue for a lot of filmmakers, actually, that they have... Like, almost all filmmakers I know are, to some degree, perfectionists. And I am, like, I'm the worst perfectionist, probably. So my collaboration with André before was actually quite good for both of us, I think, because we are perfectionists. But together we were sort of able to push each other forward. And
okay. Were you, were you perfectionists in different ways, maybe?
Yeah, I think so. I might be like more concerned about the story and the script and so on. And André has other focuses.
Like the visuals.
Visuals and production and so on. So we complemented each other quite well. So yeah, so that was very beneficial. But yeah, so my point was basically that I think filmmakers should, and myself included really, we should make more movies and stop talking about making movies. And to me, it feels like I now, after Origin, I have been talking about making movies for maybe 3 years. But it's also the process of having finished your first feature film that you did basically without financing, and then finding the financial footing just to be able to make the next film, and using the previous film to convince people that you can make a new one.
Yeah, because this is a long process of marketing and so on. Because you managed to get Origin to be available video on demand somewhere. How was that process, and where can you find it now?
I mean, you can find a movie on pretty much all of the big streaming platforms now. At least in North America and Scandinavia, you can find it on Amazon and iTunes and Hulu and Viaplay. All of the larger platforms. Yeah, so just search for it if you want to check out the movie. So that's, it's very nice that people are able to watch the movie now if they want to. I'm also, together with André, we produced the film. And on most of my projects, I am producing them also. And I also, I write and edit and direct. So producing the film also taught me a lot, not only about making the film, but also about distribution and marketing and so on. So we did handle all of those deals ourselves. But we found through connections and people who had enjoyed the movie at festivals and so on, and it got quite a bit of buzz from the awards, of course. So that led to us finding deals with a North American distributor who picked it up for all of the streaming platforms. And then through that, we also found on our own a distributor for Scandinavia. So it's really cool that they enjoyed the movie and wanted to pick it up.
Yeah, because if you don't really find a distributor, you... You've got to do everything yourself, and that's, you know, a lot of obstacles in your way.
I wouldn't say it's necessarily a bad thing to self-distribute a movie, but you have to know what you're doing. And it's the same with the distributors. So we've learned a lot from these collaborations we've had now. Some things have worked well, other things have not worked as well. And all those lessons I'm going to take with me to the next project.
Right.
And it's entirely possible that we might end up self-distributing a movie if we make a movie that feels like it should be self-distributed.
Mm. But what are the things that may not go as planned or well with the distributor?
I mean, you have the usual Hollywood stuff, right?
Right.
With people making promises and then maybe not delivering on all of those
promises. Sure, sure, sure.
And, I mean, it's the same in the Swedish movie industry also and all over the world.
Mm.
People who promise you that they can do something with a movie.
Mm.
And then some of the stuff is done, but maybe not reaching out into all of the markets that you think the movie is going to do well in.
Mm.
And if we had not sold the rights to the movie, we could have done more ourselves, maybe. So that's the pros and cons, really.
Yeah. So you sold the rights. Okay,
when you sell the rights to specific markets, then the distributor or the sales agent or whoever has the rights, they are responsible in that market.
Yeah.
So, and we can't really do other deals on our own because we don't have the rights to do that anymore.
Right.
So that's something you have to weigh the pros and cons of.
Mm-hmm. So you give your control away, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you give away the control of your baby that you have made with love during the last 3 years, maybe.
Mm.
So you really have to know that you are working with good partners.
Mm.
And that, like, being on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean is not always the easiest thing to know beforehand.
Mm. Mm. You were talking about learning by doing, by making your first feature, but what was the biggest lesson you feel? or some of them, because I bet there were a bunch of them.
Production-wise, it's of course that a feature film is a lot larger. It's a bigger project than a short film, but it's also very similar.
Mm.
So if you have made a short film that you maybe shot for like 5 days or something, then taking the step, if you can somehow find a creative way to shoot a feature film in 10 days, then the process is not that different.
Mm.
But then that could grow into 20 days or something.
Yeah.
And I mean, the logistics become larger and larger, and that goes without saying. So, I mean, the other lessons, probably to have more patience, I would say, because we both Andrea and I, we have been quite impulsive in our filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
You make a short film and like that becomes a hit online and you think like, oh cool, we can make movies, let's make another one. But you don't really sit, I mean, we have spent a lot of time thinking through projects and developing scripts and so on. But maybe we should have spent even more time developing projects.
Oh, yeah.
And being like, looking back at the younger version of myself, maybe 3-4 years ago, maybe I was a tiny bit arrogant, thinking that I know so much. Like, I know that this script is awesome. This is going to be a great movie. And then when people told me, maybe you should work more on the script, I was like, the script is awesome.
You don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
This is so, mine.
Yeah, and
my creation.
It's really hard to convince yourself, not necessarily when you're that age, but it's easy to understand afterwards that maybe people had their feedback was very valid. And then of course you also get lots of feedback which you really shouldn't listen to, so and that's
absolutely
really hard to know.
I've talked about this before. I think getting feedback can sometimes be very beneficial to work out what you want to do yourself or what your own opinion is, if you're not really sure. If you're asking somebody, do you like A or B? And they say B, and you're like, no, I think A.
Yeah.
Because I just realized why.
it's like being at it's called the optometrist, right? Where you get your glasses.
Yeah, sure.
Like, and they do that, like the eye
better
test.
Better or worse?
Yeah,
better
exactly.
Or worse?
That's the thing with feedback all of the time. And you like, and at a certain point in time at the optometrist, you just start lying because you don't see any difference between A and B anymore.
You're like, what's up with that?
I think A is better.
Yeah. What's up with that? You want to make the right choice.
Yeah.
And it's the right choice for you. It's not like you have to please them.
No, but it feels like you have to please
exactly.
The optometrist, basically.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing with feedback and judging your own decision-making process, basically. When you're editing, when you're writing a script and so on, you always have like the little voice behind your head questioning all of your choices.
Yep.
And if it's not that little voice, then it's probably like someone, your financiers or something, or a film critic.
Mm.
Or, you know, you're always having people question your judgment as an artist.
As an artist, do you feel that that voice sometimes represents some phantom public, the ideal audience member, or somebody you respect, or whatever like that? So you don't really only do what you want to do. You'll also do things to please other people.
Yeah, for me it's super important to actually make movies that are relevant to an audience. I mean, I'm a really big movie fan. I love movies. I love good TV shows and series. But making my own films, I'm not making them for myself. I'm making them for an audience.
Okay. That's kind of rare, I'd say.
Yeah, I mean, at least with people I talk to in the community we're both a part of, a lot of people make films for themselves. And I've talked to many filmmakers who tell me, I don't really care if an audience likes this movie.
Right.
And so on. But for me, it's like, why would I make a movie if people wouldn't like it? Then I can just like, then I can have the fun ideas in my head or whatever. Or I can go play video games or watch another movie or something. But to me, the process is very much like, I might watch a really great movie or watch a cool trailer or something. And I'm like, wow, that's super cool. Maybe I should also make something that's that cool. Or like at one point, like the great filmmakers I admire are not going to be here anymore. So who are going to fill their shoes?
Okay. So like, okay.
It's not really that I have to, or I feel that it's sort of like something I should do, but like someone is going to fill their shoes. So I might as well try.
Whose shoes do you want to fill?
Yeah, this is when I'm going to sound pretentious.
Go on.
No, I mean, like, but the filmmakers I really admire are, of course, people like Steven Spielberg and Christopher Nolan, David Fincher. I mean, there's lots of great directors, Park Chan-wook or Chan-wook Park, depending on how you want to pronounce your Asian names. I mean, but yeah, basically Spielberg is the biggest one for me. Even though a lot of people think his film language is sentimental, I don't mind sentiment. I go to the movies to have my emotions affected. I mean, for me, making movies is painting with emotion.
I've been saying that we as actors, we deal with emotions. That's our trade.
No, so I don't have illusions of ever being able to fill Steven Spielberg's shoes, or Nolan's for that matter. But like, I might be able to learn a little bit of why they have made successful movies, and lots of other filmmakers, and filmmakers who are in the same community that I'm part of, and just try to make the best movies I can, and try to make a better movie each time I make a new one. So then maybe at some point I will make movies that I feel are that an audience might really enjoy. Because right now it's like, okay, cool, we have won awards, so somehow the movies I've made are resonating with people. But looking back at the films you have made, of course I'm critical of my own work. So you're always like, oh, I could have done that better. Yeah, exactly. Because that's how you grow. But like, I think it's also good to have something to aim at. So hopefully I don't come off as too arrogant in saying that, yes, it would be awesome if I could make movies that were as good as Spielberg one day. But I don't think, like, I'm nowhere near that right now. And I might never get there. But I'm still, that's where I'm trying to aim. Just because, like, one of my philosophies is always, like, to aim really, really high. Because then at least you're going to get a bit of the way.
Higher.
Higher than if you don't aim at all. So, yeah, that's what I try.
Sure. But I'm going to suggest something now, because we're talking about this making things for others or yourself and whatever. But if you only thought about yourself and did exactly the type of movie that you wanted to make, wouldn't the audience for that movie just be apparent when it's out? They would somebody would find it. And sometimes you don't you want to make something creative that people don't really know that they want until they see it and like, damn, this is wow.
You know, that's very true. I think you're spot on, that the best movies and the best experiences are the ones we're not expecting. So it's really hard to know. But I think what I'm talking about is mostly about, as a filmmaker, as a writer and director, being aware that I'm making this for someone else. I'm not making this for me. So even if I'm trying to make something new or exciting, something that's exciting in a new way, just having in the back of my head that I'm making this for someone else, for them to enjoy it. And I might enjoy this scene a lot, but it might not be make the most sense to have it in the movie. So I might need to cut it out. So it's also about killing your darlings.
Yeah, sure.
And not like, because I feel some filmmakers, they totally just make movies for themselves.
Mm.
And then it's very much a throw of the dice if the audience are going to like it or not.
Mm.
And going back to what you were saying about me being a methodical person,
mm-hmm.
I guess I am, because what I try to do is try to do as much as I can to ensure, you can never ensure, but like try to do as much as I can to ensure that an audience are going to enjoy the movies I make.
Mm. Yeah, because I guess you don't really kill your darlings that much if you just make something for yourself.
Yeah.
Interesting. But you mentioned festivals, like you had won some awards and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I know you've gone to festivals to try to sell your film and everything.
Yeah.
And how do you feel about festivals? Is that like a necessary evil, or do you have festivals that you recommend and stuff like that?
I think festivals are, I mean, to be realistic, they're very much a part of the film community.
Yeah.
And they are very necessary to bring attention to smaller movies in particular.
Mm.
And they are their own little film competitions, usually. Mm. So the movies that do well at festivals, either that they have a great response from the audience or that they might end up winning awards and so on.
Mm.
It is a spotlight for the movies. So it's basically going to festivals is... You take your movie on the road, show it to as many people as possible at all of the festivals that accept your movie. And then you just try to show it to people and hope they like it.
Mm.
And through that, maybe you get like rings on the water spreading into something larger and larger.
Mm.
So I think festivals are really good. It's a really good window to get attention for your movies. But it also depends on the movie. I mean, that's also why the blockbusters, you don't see them premiering at festivals, because they already have their audience, basically.
Mm,
But if you're doing something original where you're not basing it on a previous work or a book or something, then you need attention. And it becomes about marketing. So how do you market your movie or your product or whatever to make people know that it's there and know that it's good?
Mm.
And then that's where festivals are really, really useful, because you have passionate people usually running the festivals.
Mm.
They love movies and they want to promote good movies. So if you find festival programmers who love your movie, then they are going to help you.
Yeah,
because they screen your movie at the festivals because they love the movie, and then they hope more people are going to love the movie.
Mm.
And then in our case, that led to us winning awards in Argentina and in Sydney and so on, and in Spain. And that creates more buzz.
Yeah.
And that might lead to more festivals. It might lead to deals with distribution deals and so on.
Mm.
And hopefully it makes it easier to make the next movie. Because that was also one of the considerations when we made Origin. That, like, it's basically a catch-22. No one's going to let you direct a feature film unless you have directed a feature film, basically. Or short films that have won at festivals, basically.
Mm-hmm.
The reasoning was basically, if we make a feature film, even if we make it a low-budget feature film and like put our heart into it, then if we succeed in doing this, we have made a feature film.
Mm.
And hopefully that will make it easier to make the next one.
Yeah. Do you have any particular festivals that you feel have helped you, especially those that have given you awards?
Mm. I would say all of them. I mean, we had our international premiere at Fantasboa in Brazil, which is a fairly small festival, but it's a very hardcore genre festival.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So it's sci-fi fantasy and horror and shit.
Yeah, It's very much, I would say, very much a horror festival. Really.
Okay.
And our movie isn't that much of a horror film, so I almost felt a little bit on the outskirts with, like, people loving gore and, like, lots of blood in their movies. And I'm like, hey, look at our Swedish... dramatic thriller, which people still enjoyed a lot.
Yeah.
And I mean, we won an award for best actor at Buenos Aires Rojo Sangre in Argentina, which basically means Buenos Aires Red Blood.
another horror festival,
yeah,
I guess.
It's South America's biggest horror festival.
And
for some reason, our movie did really well in Hispanic countries. I'm half Spanish, but I don't know how that would affect the movie, because the movie is in Swedish.
Yeah, no.
It has nothing to do with Spain or like Hispanic countries.
And you don't have any like Hispanic type of...
I don't know. Maybe it's like between the lines in the script or something.
Right.
Like just the story resonates with Hispanic people.
Just a Latin feel.
Yeah, maybe.
Here's some kind of backbeat with the claves or something.
Yeah.
All right. And I know you've been to Berlinale. Have you been to Cannes?
No, I've never been to Cannes.
Really?
I mean, because the reasoning has always been... You, maybe you know better than me, but honestly, to me, it feels like it's good to go to the big festivals if you really have something to show.
Yeah.
But otherwise, just going if you don't have a project to have meetings about, then it's basically just for fun. You go, I mean, you make connections and so on.
Yeah.
But also, it's quite a big cost to go to the big festivals. So our reasoning has been, it's not worth it for us to spend the money to go to Cannes if we don't have a movie ready for production.
Right.
Or we don't have these projects that we want to take meetings for. Then it's better to spend our time and our money staying here and developing the projects and doing other kinds of stuff and visiting the festivals where our movie is actually playing.
Yeah, that's exactly what I've heard, especially when it comes to Cannes. Like, you don't really have any reason to go to Cannes unless you have a project showing there or something you need to push.
Yeah.
And if you have meetings and stuff like that, because Cannes seems to have a lot of closed doors.
Yeah,
yeah, you need to have invitations and so on to do anything. So most people who've been there tell me when I've presented them with the idea, maybe I should go to Cannes. Like, not really, don't.
Yeah.
Unless you want to go there for fun.
Yeah, or you have set up meetings beforehand.
Yeah,
that's what a lot of people do. So yeah, but I mean, like when we released Original, so we got all of these emails from all of like the big companies, all of the top talent agencies, distribution companies. They're like, hey, we're like this big production company. We usually work with Tom Cruise and so on. We would love to watch your movie. And like, that kind of stuff happens. And the first time it happens to you, you're like so excited because you're like, oh my God, we're going to like, this is going to be big.
Yeah.
And then you talk to, I talked to Antonio in this case and he was like, that, yeah, that just happens. It's part of the process.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, sure.
Probably the, in, and most likely nothing is going to happen from it, but you are going to get so many messages when your movie starts getting a bit of a buzz. So that's a good thing to just be aware of as a filmmaker.
Yeah, yeah.
Cause, and that's also part of the entire Hollywood promising a lot of stuff. So it's a lot of empty promises or like promises about this could happen, basically. But everyone always just promises a lot of stuff. So you have to learn to take things with a grain of salt, basically.
Always Google everybody.
Yeah, so, no, but also
know who they are.
Yeah, but the thing is also like you get these emails from people who, and their job title is usually like creative producer or whatever, but they're usually an assistant to an assistant to an assistant at a talent agency or at a big production company. And they want to show your project to their boss, so they get a promotion, basically. Or they want to be the person who found out about this cool Swedish movie, if the cool Swedish movie ends up being a big hit. So, yeah, I mean, it's all part of the process. And you, I mean, that's also how you learn by doing. But I think you have just have to stay grounded and understand that like no one is special, really. Everyone's just a regular person trying to do their job the best they can. It's just that maybe in Hollywood they have a special way of doing things.
Yeah,
and you have to be aware.
And some people have more power than others, and more experience than others, and good taste. And
so, yeah,
yeah. How important do you think gut feeling is when it comes to these things? Because I know I have a strong gut feeling when it comes to projects, people, things like that.
Yeah.
All these empty promises you were talking about and everything like that. But when you are starting out, you don't really want to listen to your gut feeling, because if somebody says, hey, do you want to be in my film? Or did you here's some money to, I want to distribute your movie. You're like, yeah, yeah, sure. Let's do it. It doesn't feel right because of a lot of reasons, but hey, yeah, sure. Because you don't want, you really want to be the person who declines anything at that point. Have you had that experience?
No, I think I agree that it's very important to trust your gut. So if you really feel that this feels fishy or I don't really trust this person, then don't make the deal with that person. And that's also my, like, the few times I have made decisions where I was a little bit dubious if it was a good decision or not, and I have still made a deal.
Yeah,
it usually comes back to bite you in the ass.
Right.
So at the same time, I would also say if you're at the beginning of your career, it's really good to make as many projects as you can. So if people ask you, do you want to be in my short film? I can't pay you anything. If you have nothing better to do, then be in the short film. Like, just for the, because then it's about just building a repertoire of work.
Yeah, yeah,
like
sure.
Having made a lot of films and short films or feature films or whatever. But if someone comes asking you like, hey, we want to distribute your film, that you maybe paid, let's say you paid a lot of money to make the film, and it comes telling you, we want to distribute it, but we're not going to pay you anything, then maybe that might not be the best deal.
Yeah. And you never heard of them. And
Exactly. Yeah. So, but you always have to weigh things. But yeah, go with your gut, I would say. Mm. Always.
Check. Google people.
Yeah.
I think it's good. Yeah.
Yeah, and also like Google people, but also try to ask others if you have a network of people. Because that's also something I'm really glad we did when we found our distributors. Because like we had offers from other companies. And then I was lucky enough to have met other filmmakers at festivals. Because that's also one of the great things about festivals. You meet other filmmakers and become friends with them. So then I reached out to the filmmakers I knew. And they're from like Switzerland or France and Germany and so on. So they had previous relationships with some of the companies that were approaching us about the film. So and then I could just ask them, what's your relationship? And they were like, oh, red flags everywhere. Like, don't work with this company. And then you don't. So trust your gut, but also trust your people.
Trust your people. Trust your contacts, And contacts are super important in this business. Because also, sometimes you may feel like, oh, my skill and what I've done may be everything I need. But no, you need to know people. And you can see that all the way up to like Hollywood blockbuster level, that some directors just want to work with the same people they've always worked with. And that's the same across the board, probably.
Yeah,
they want to work with people they trust and know personally for some reason. For some reason, we know the reasons. But
I mean, you get the shorthand with people you work with a lot. So it's, of course, people are going to work with the ones they have worked with before and where the collaboration has worked well.
Because you
don't have to guess, is this collaboration going to work or not? So I also have collaborators that I felt like the collaborations have gone really, really well. And then my natural inclination is to ask the same people the next time. Because, of course, I could find others that are as good or even better, maybe. And it's good to be open still. Like, don't close yourself off too much about trying new people, because you might find new collaborations that are working really, really well.
And you might need it.
Yeah, exactly.
For different reasons.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about the story of, do you know the story of Ewan McGregor and Danny Boyle, that they always worked together until Danny Boyle made The Beach? Because then he needed somebody, he needed a bigger star, and he used Leonardo DiCaprio. And so they fell out, and they weren't friends for years because of that thing.
Yeah.
It took years before they found each other again and even wanted to talk to each other about it. And so I guess those things can happen all the time as well.
Yeah, and it's tough because, yes, you have your collaborations with people you love working with, but then the realities of the business is also that it is show business.
Yeah.
So your projects, at least in my world, a movie has to make back its budget at least, and preferably also make a profit. And in that case, if you can make, if you can ensure that your movie is going to have better chances of making back its budget or making a profit by maybe choosing different actors, then that might be the smart move to make.
Yeah, or even be able to make the movie
at all,
because you might not get the financing unless you have a name.
Yeah, and then it's all, I guess it's still about just being the, like, rooting for your team. Like, if you are sure that this actor I have worked a lot with before is going to be great in this part, and you know that, then you have to just, like, champion that actor.
Yeah.
And tell the studio or the financier or whatever that I know that the movie is going to be really, really good with this actor. I know it might be easier to make if we get like one of your A-list actors, or that it's going to be easier to market it to people. But the movie's not going to be as good.
No.
So, yeah, so you have to fight your battles. And
hopefully you can do a mix.
Yeah.
Put
exactly.
one name in and then use your people. Yeah. Do you feel like you're getting to that level? Like, if you want to make another feature soon, like, it would be good for you to actually have some kind of name brand actor in this case, to get your financing, because you probably want to make something with a bigger budget now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, also going back to Berlinale and European Film Market and so on, that was basically the biggest response we got on the movie. It was, this looks really good, but your actors are not famous enough for us to be able to market it.
Right.
So, and that's also the show business aspect of it. So on my next film, I will probably try to get the best actors that are also as famous as possible.
Mm.
Or maybe not necessarily as famous as possible, but it is beneficial to the movie if you have actors that are going to draw an audience. Because, I mean, it's a competition for people's time and attention.
Mm.
And what are you going to choose if you're going to go to the movies with your date or something, and you see like five posters and one of them has Tom Cruise? Mm. At least like a 90% chance you're going to watch the Tom Cruise movie or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So unless you have heard really, really good things about this small movie with unknown actors.
Mm.
But I mean, to me, that's like people who are in our community who make films and so on, they might choose to watch the smaller movie because they have heard from their filmmaking friends that this is a great movie.
Mm.
Whereas the general audience, they don't really hear that so much.
No.
Because like they are bombarded, or we are bombarded, with marketing.
Yeah.
And it's not even close, the marketing budgets of a small movie and, let's say, a Hollywood movie, or even the larger Swedish movies. So it's really tough to compete against the bigger movies if you're making a low-budget film or even a medium-budget film.
Mm. Yeah, marketing is so important.
Yeah, and that's why you might need the bigger actors, the big names, because if you have that in your small movie, then TV shows are going to want to interview your actor. And you might be able to have the face of the famous actors on posters and so on.
Mm.
And people see that. So yeah, it's very strategic. And that's also about producing your own movies. You have to be very strategic about all the choices you make.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Unless you're very rich as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Like me. If you,
that's not a problem I have,
no,
unfortunately.
Problem, sure. Let's call it a problem. I mean, if you were to make another movie on in the same style as Origin, and I gave you $100 million just for marketing, then that would probably be a hit because everybody would be aware of it because you sold this money.
And I would say also, like, even if you gave me $100 million to make my next film, I would probably still look at bigger actors, not maybe for all of the roles, but just to make sure that people are aware of the film, because I want as many people as possible to enjoy the film. And it's really great to make a movie that you feel that you made a proper good movie. But if no one's gonna see it anyway, or if it ends up like in the bottom drawer at Netflix or something, hey, why did I waste my life making a movie that no one ever saw? And in our case, fortunately, people did see the film and they are seeing the film. But if we had had bigger actors, then of course more people would have seen it.
But do you have a script happening right now? Are you like in the first, second draft or something?
Yeah, right now I am developing a script for a new feature film. That I'm probably not going to talk too much about.
No, sure. Secret stuff?
Nah, it's not too secret, really. But I like to keep the story process fairly private. Because maybe it's because I'm a perfectionist also. I talk to some people about the ideas and so on. But like when the ideas are just in my head, I can play around with them a lot. And I don't feel that I have to put it out on display, or I don't want to put it out on display before I feel it's almost there.
Because you will be affected.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't want to second guess my own intuition at the start of a creative process. So that's when I research a lot. I try to develop the characters and try to find the story. Because I do like to outline a lot. So that's where I'm at right now, basically. I have an outline for a feature film that I've been thinking about this story for maybe like 5-10 years. And I think it's it's a very promising concept. It's something I read about a long time ago. And I think there is a great story here. And for me, it's about finding what is the best way to tell this story in a way that is going to emotionally affect the audience and affect me. And how can I interpret the feelings I get when thinking about this story and translate those to the screen in the best way possible? So that's why we're currently in the outlining process and trying to find who are the main characters, really, who are they, and what scenes are going to make the most impact and going to tell the story in the best way possible. So we're developing story on the project right now.
Oh, right.
And not trying to move too fast.
Ah, right.
Yeah. So hopefully we can get a little bit of a larger budget than the previous film, and hopefully we might shoot next year.
Oh, okay. That's pretty quickly.
It's pretty quick, but in my world, it's fairly slow. Sure. Because usually, like before, I've been moving quite fast. So beforehand, it might have been like, okay, we had an idea for a short film, and maybe like a month later, we were shooting it. And with the feature film, it was basically maybe like half a year before we shot the film. Maybe we started writing it a year before, and then we shot it the summer after. But it was basically the first idea was, let's shoot a feature film next summer.
And let's make that happen. Yeah, and in any way possible.
It didn't start with the idea for the film. It started with, let's shoot a feature film. And let's see which of the stories we are developing could be that film. And then how could we twist and turn that idea into a low-budget feature film? Which worked quite well, actually.
Yeah.
So it's also good to set your deadlines and work toward them. But in this case, trying to learn from my mistakes, basically. I want to make sure to make, if we're not going to get the biggest budget, because I have the big budget ideas also.
Sure.
But I'm not going to be naive and try to make my big Hollywood blockbuster idea now, because the likelihood of getting the $300 million now is not very good.
Yeah, no.
So I also have smaller ideas that are very dramatic and heartfelt. So that's probably going to be the next film. And it's a small character drama with a bit of a twist, but it's not a big sci-fi or fantasy thing. It's quite grounded, and it's about characters. Because that's also, I mean, that's what I like the most about good movies or good TV shows, when you start caring about the characters. And when it comes to the point where you almost feel like you're friends with the characters and you're like watching a good TV show, like Downton Abbey, for example, which I'm a big fan of. In that show, they are able to make you like or care about almost all of the characters. And there are maybe like 20 characters. And they each have their own stories, and it feels quite natural. And then you're like you're going all day wanting to sit on the couch that evening to watch your friends again, because you care about the characters. And I mean, movies are different because you have such a short time span of 1.5-2 hours to make people care about the characters. So that's really important to me, that the audience are gonna really care about the characters. And I think maybe last time in Origin, maybe I tried a little bit too hard to make people care about the characters. Also because it has such strong emotions, that movie, because it is about life and death situations and so on.
High stakes.
Yeah, the stakes are very high. And also maybe we needed a little bit more time to let people develop their relationship to the characters. Because that's something very different.
You mean you like kind of forced the characters on people? Like,
maybe
this is a nice person, like this person.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's always about emotional manipulation. You're doing stuff or telling a story in a particular way to make people care about the characters. So, of course, we use those tools to make people care about our main character. But an interesting thing that a lot of people told me at when I was at the film festival in Torremolinos in Spain, almost all of the people who came up to talk to me after the movie said that they really preferred the first half of the movie, which was slower in pace, than the last half of the movie, which was quite intense. And that was interesting for me, because like, to me, it was the other way around. I was the most proud about the last half of the film, because that's quite action-packed and intense. And I was like, we managed to shoot some really good action scenes.
Sure.
But we still, like...
view at it from your angle.
Yeah, but that audience really enjoyed the character development in the first half of the film.
Yeah.
So that was really cool also. And not to say that the next movie is only going to be character development, but I think it is important to me that the audience really care about the characters.
I feel that about most movies, actually. I usually like the first half of most movies before too much trouble starts. I love the world building and getting to know characters and when things are still kind of okay. And then the conflict starts up and like, oh.
But it's also because, I mean, you have seen almost all movies before. Almost no movies are completely original. So when the dramatic stuff starts happening, you're almost always reminded of other movies, or you're like, it becomes a little bit predictable, maybe. But when it's about the characters, there are so many people on this planet, and everyone is living their unique life. So it's really interesting to just follow a character and understand a character. because you don't really know how people are going to act and what they're going to do. Okay, in a Hollywood movie, maybe they're just going to follow that dramatic curve.
Sometimes,
But that's not usually what's predictable. The character development is usually not that predictable. What's predictable is the action and the drama and so on, and the external events happening.
Mm.
So I completely agree that, yeah, that becomes predictable.
How do you feel about predictability when it comes to scripts and movies? Do you like that things follow some kind of structure that we know and love and have been doing since like 2,000 years ago or whatever? Or do you like to be really surprised and that they break rules, like maybe they plant something that's never used and do these kind of things that some people would say, this is bad filmmaking, but no, maybe it's you know, it's surprising. I'm thinking, for example, you know the story about when Kevin Smith wrote Red State?
Mm-hmm.
He decided that whenever he knew himself where this was going, he would do a total 180 and do something that surprised even him. And when you see the film, you kind of feel like that. You get that because some people in the film feels like they're going to be the protagonist and then they just die. That's not the main guy.
it's a really good question, actually, because I'm really averse to movies that do the thing where they end the movie before the ending. I'm like, nothing makes me more irritated and mad than a movie that just like cuts off before we see the ending. Because I'm really passionate about movies and I do have opinions. So if a movie does something that irritates me, I'm going to think about that for maybe like a week or something. my latest thing is like The Shape of Water.
Okay.
Yeah. So like...
I love The Shape of Water.
I really love this idea behind The Shape of Water.
Yeah.
But it's a really shitty film. Unfortunately,
shitty film. Interesting.
Because
best picture winner.
The best picture winner. I mean, I love Guillermo del Toro. I think he's a great filmmaker. But The Shape of Water was not a finished movie. It has so many plot holes, and it has a great concept. But I think they should just have kept developing the script for maybe half a year longer or something.
Maybe.
And
I kind of agree with you. Actually,
it's entirely possible that they decided to cut away too much of the movie. Like they cut it down too much, maybe. Or they just didn't develop the script more, because I think Sally Hawkins is amazing in the movie.
Oh yeah.
And I love the concept, and like the sentimentalist in me really loves the love story in it and everything. But then it's like there are so many things in that movie that are, and I mean, it's hard to complain about Guillermo del Toro. But at the same time, there are so many things that don't really feel finished, and like it's, yes, it looks polished, but the entire filmmaking process of it feels kind of rushed. So I really wanted to love The Shape of Water, but I ended up not really loving it as much as I hoped to.
And that may be a Guillermo del Toro thing, though. He is a style more than he is a story
person,
maybe. And I think that's what I love about The Shape of Water, is that in the same way, like Blade Runner is like a feeling and a mood, Shape of Water is that too.
Yeah, but then you look at previous movies he has done, like...
Pan's Labyrinth.
Labyrinth, but even more so The Devil's Backbone. Which is like a really solid story. That's a really solid ghost story and a drama, and the pace is slower. And then like, I know he hasn't made it, but movies that he has produced, like The Orphanage, for example, where you have a really well-told story. So the movies I really like are the well-told stories. And also the well-made experiences, because looking at a movie like Dunkirk, for example, I mean, yes, it's... I don't know. I'm not sure if I'm going to say that it's well-written, but it's an amazing experience to me. Because you really just follow the characters, and it was very intriguing that there's not really that much dialogue in the movie.
No.
So it's not very traditional in that sense.
That's true.
You just follow the characters, and it's so intense, and you're just with it. So in that case, I love that movie. But usually, I have a hard time with movies that strayed too much from the three-act structure, basically. And maybe, because like looking at a movie like The Square, for example. Have you seen it?
No.
No.
The second podcast in a row I had to answer that question. Sorry.
I enjoyed that movie more than I thought I would.
Oh, yeah.
But it was also one of these movies that to me basically just feels like different scenes string together to make a movie, where there's not really enough of a story for me. And for me, it's very important that I'm told a good story. And I want a beginning, I want a middle, and I want an end in particular. I want the movie to move towards something, to tell me a story and to, like, not necessarily tell me, like, and they lived happily ever after. But I want things to be wrapped up, and somehow I want to be told an ending, and a good ending. And, of course, the like, if it's an unexpected ending, that's the best.
Okay, yeah.
I mean,
you love twists and stuff.
Yeah, I love twists. Yeah. I mean, like, I love movies like The Sixth Sense and so on. But then, of course, Shyamalan became predictable, so he had to twist his twists, basically. And that's a hard position to be in if people are expecting you to do the twist. But no, I love being surprised. And that's what I aim to also be able to do. But it's hard. Because your ideal ending should be... not necessarily predictable, but it should be unexpected, but also the natural ending. Like it should feel
satisfying.
Yeah, maybe. it should when the ending happens, it should feel, of course this is the ending. Of course this is how it's gonna end. But at the same time you're supposed to be surprised about it.
It had to end this way, but I'm still surprised that it did. Yeah, something like that, I guess.
Yeah.
Do you think Guillermo del Toro has too much like big studio pressure nowadays? Might that be
maybe. I mean, I don't know his situation particularly. I know he has had quite a hard time to get the movies he has wanted to make financed.
At the Mountains of Madness, it never got off the ground, unfortunately. I really want to see that.
But maybe that happens now with the Oscar. So that's good. Yeah. But to me, I mean, the Oscars... they are quite interesting because a lot of the time it feels like it's career awards and so on. Not necessarily always this was the best movie in that category and so on, but like we want to award this person. But it's hard. I mean, it's also people have such different tastes in movies. So, I mean, no one's ever going to agree. Just because I prefer Dunkirk, maybe, or let's say with the sound editing and sound mixing, Dunkirk was really good, but... so was Baby Driver, and how do you choose?
Yeah,
I mean it's a really tough job to.
Yeah, I thought Baby Driver should have the editing.
I agree.
Award.
Yeah,
it didn't get that one.
No, it
didn't. Yeah, that was one of the ones I got wrong.
Yeah.
Did you sit up while watching the?
Yeah, we did.
It wasn't a good year for me when it came to guessing. I think I got 11 out of 24 right. Yeah,
but do you usually guess the movies that you think are going to win or the ones you want to win?
Both. I'm trying to balance those out. Mm-hmm. And what I felt this year was that it was such a strong year. Mm-hmm. So none of the awards... was wrong to me. It was like, okay, that's not what I picked myself, but it's still well deserved.
Yeah. No, I agree.
The only one was the song. I thought This Is Me is a stronger song, probably. So that surprised me a little bit. The only one. Any snubs?
Well, I think, I mean, Baby Driver should have been nominated for Best Picture. That's really weird to me that it wasn't nominated.
Yeah, I agree.
Because I think Edgar Wright is such a joy as a filmmaker.
Yeah.
And he makes better and better movies each time. And Baby Driver was just so enjoyable to watch. So it's really weird to me that it wasn't even nominated for Best
Picture. It's not an Academy Award type film.
No, it's not. But also, isn't that sad that we have not an Academy Award type film? And it's the same with, like, did you see The Lonely Island were supposed to make a musical number for the Oscars that wasn't made? There's this really fun music video, or like a video they put on YouTube. So just like if you Google for Lonely Island and Oscars, they posted a mock-up of what they were intending to do. And it's basically a montage of different superheroes singing about why they weren't Oscar nominated. I mean, because I'm not necessarily saying that superhero movies are the best movies now, but...
No.
Like, for example, Logan was a really good movie.
Yeah.
Even, like...
And had one nomination.
Yeah. For Best Screenplay, I think, right?
Yeah.
But, like, to me, that movie should also probably have been nominated for Best Picture. Also, because they have, like, 10 movies. And I, unfortunately, haven't seen all of them.
No.
And it's a taste thing. Of course, you're not going to agree with all of them. But it is a little bit sad. And I think we're still going to get there where more genre movies are nominated. I'm really happy about Get Out winning Best Screenplay.
Oh, yeah, me too.
Because I love that movie. And it is a genre movie. But then it still managed to sneak its way in there.
It's a lot about buzz, too.
Yeah.
Whatever people are talking about in the industry. I think it's interesting that the Academy Awards is the industry giving awards to the industry. So that's a special kind of thing. And of course, there's a lot of politics going on there.
Yeah.
But then we have Golden Globes, we have the Independent Spirit Awards, and we have the People's Choice and all that, that get, you know, give awards to other things.
Yeah.
It's interesting to see, you can almost guess, like, this movie's going to do well at the Independent Spirit Awards, but not at the Academy Awards, probably, and things like that.
Oh, by the way, I'm really happy about Roger Deakins winning a Cinematography Award.
Yeah,
that
finally.
Was about time.
It was about time.
Yeah.
And Blade Runner looks amazing. And I thought it was going to get sound mixing, actually, because the sound is incroyable. Besides your filmmaking, you do work with film when it comes to just making money, don't you?
Like, yeah.
How do you feel about that, doing something for money that is similar to your passion?
I mean, to me, it's the same thing. I'm very lucky and I guess also quite hard working when it comes to being able to do this for a living. Because I run a production company together with my partner Jennifer and our colleague Michelle also. And we make commercials and corporate video and so on.
Yeah.
And we are able to live from doing that, which has been a dream of mine for a long time. I mean, being able to live by making movies. Ideally, that would be making feature films and fiction work.
Yeah.
But it's really hard to do that. So we're working toward it. And right now, that is about making a lot of commercials and that kind of work. But it's cool. I mean, because I guess I am a bit of an entrepreneur also. So running your own company, being able to decide over your own time and what projects you work on. And you can say no to a client if you don't want to do that project or something.
Yeah.
And you can work with the clients that you think have interesting projects. And you also find interesting collaborations with clients. So people you enjoy working with, and then you continue working with those people. And ideally, this should also give us more time to develop new fiction projects, even though we do focus a lot on the stuff that brings in money right now.
Because
that's also after doing Origin and having my personal finances not doing that great because we've invested so much money into making a feature film. I just had to double down and focus on making money again. And being able to do that, running my own company where we make films, that's pretty great. I mean, it's a lot of work. But yeah, I'm such a... I think I have to work that way, basically. I'm not really good at having others decide what I'm supposed to do. So just having having a regular job just isn't my thing. Yeah, I made my own thing.
And you don't feel like it takes energy away from other filmmaking because you, like, let's say you have a certain amount of filmmaking energy and you have to allocate it to this too much?
It does in a way. And maybe if I had like a regular desk job or something, I would be able to after that feel like, oh, now I want to work on my movie. So
you want to sit at the editing desk, but you maybe don't want to do that if you've already done that 8 hours.
No, and that's a bit of a problem, but then you find ways around it. So, for example, during the summer months, there's not that much work coming in from clients because everyone's on vacation. So then you try to schedule your own film projects in those holes in the calendar, basically, where you're not going to have that much client work. But yeah, I mean, that's how a lot of people in the film industry make it work. You have to do your own passion projects, but also work on other people's projects, no matter if that's you actually working on other people's feature productions or working with commercials and so on. And I mean, in our case, it's not only that we're not only hired to work on other people's projects, but we actually produce the entire projects, commercials and so on, which also gives us more control. I mean, it's always a struggle also, because like some months you make quite good money and other months there's nothing, basically. So you don't have the stability of having a regular job, which is also one of the trade-offs. But I think so with most creative work, there are trade-offs.
Sure. And almost none of us have the stability.
No, exactly. So it's just, it comes with the territory. Yeah, but I wouldn't trade it away. I really enjoy working this way and being able to control and decide over my own time. And hopefully it should be able to give me more time to work on my creative projects and more time to keep developing and working on the next feature film. And we might also do some short films, actually. Yeah, I think so. We might do... maybe one or two short films this year.
Interesting. Yeah. So you don't really feel like you just want to do features from now?
Of course, ideally, if people come with the financing, and they're like, we're going to finance your feature films, just go do feature films, then sure, I would gladly accept to do that. But I also think not having really directed any fiction work on my own since origin. I think for me, people still view me and André as a directing team. Because people still, I have people come up to me and they ask me about André's new project because they think I'm still part of it. And I'm like, oh, we're not collaborating anymore. And so I still think I need to establish myself as a filmmaker in my own rights because I know that what I can do. But I still feel somehow I might have to prove myself a little bit. And short films might be a way to do that.
Yeah, and you have some short film ideas you just want to get out there.
Yeah, no, you always have cool ideas and stuff you want to try. And then it's about finding the time and the budget for it and so on, the best way to make those projects. I really look forward to getting back to fiction work. And being able to play with that in that arena a little bit.
And I'm really impressed that Origin has gotten as far as it has being in Swedish. That's pretty cool. So going forward with your short films and your next feature, are they in Swedish or are you going to switch to English just to make it more accessible?
It's a really good point. I think Swedish is a limitation internationally, but it's mostly about the U.S. and people there not enjoying reading subtitles.
All right, you don't find that anywhere else.
But I mean, in most other countries, like in Germany, they dub movies. In Spain, they dub movies and so on. So it's not that big of an issue.
Yeah, it's interesting to see yourself dubbed in different languages. I've been dubbed in several. Hindi is the most fun one.
That might not be a big problem. But of course, I mean, if you are able to make a project, an international project with international actors, of course, those actors are also going to help you reach out with the project. So I'm completely not averse to making a movie in English, but it would have to be with actors who are really confident in that language. Because I know that you are very proficient in speaking English, but few Swedish actors are that good at speaking English. So you have to pick the right actors. You have to know what you're doing. So I think probably the next movie, the next feature film we make, is probably going to be a mix of Swedish and Norwegian or Danish, actually. Because also looking at the financing opportunities.
Nordic collaboration.
Yeah, exactly. We are looking at more international collaborations and co-productions because you might be able to get a bit of the financing from Sweden and a bit of the financing from Norway or Denmark. And then also, Swedish is such a small market, really, with like 9 million people or 10 million or whatever we are right now. And how big of a percentage of that are going to go watch your movie. So if you also make a movie that both feels Swedish and Norwegian, then you have twice the market, basically. And look at TV shows like The Bridge, for example, where you combine Sweden and Denmark. And it to both nations, it feels like their own show. And then Scandinavian things are so popular right now. So I think that might be a smart thing to do, basically. It all depends on the financing. I mean, it might just be a Swedish movie with Swedish actors. But if it's going to be easier for us to make the movie if one of the actors is Norwegian or Danish, or we might shoot half of the movie in Copenhagen or something, then, of course, we're going to look at that as an opportunity.
Yeah, that's interesting with when it comes to populations and stuff, and that Swedish is such a small language.
It comes back to the entire fact of wanting your movie to be seen by the largest audience possible.
And here it's probably even more important to have a big name, because then no Swede will check it out. It's such a contrast as well, talking about countries with big populations. And you know, the biggest thing I've done is Snowpiercer, and it's a Korean film, and 11 million people saw it in the cinema in Korea alone. That's more people than live in this whole country, and it feels weird.
In Sweden, like, they're happy if 100,000 people see a movie in in cinemas. It's such a big contrast. And to me, that's not really a sustainable system. So looking forward also, I mean, not only now, but wanting to keep making movies into, like, when I'm 60, 70 years old, how are we going to make that system sustainable? And I think also with most productions moving, or things moving over to the VOD platforms like Netflix and similar alternatives, that's going to be a really interesting change, basically. Because personally, I don't really feel that strongly that you have to watch movies in a cinema. And I know it's kind of blasphemy. I love watching a good movie at the cinema. But also with the current pricing of movie tickets and so on, it's really hard to, because then you have to choose, basically, for most people I know, it's the same discussion. Like, if they're going to go to the movies, you really have to choose one of the maybe 10 movies playing.
Mm.
Or maybe you go to the cinema once a month or something.
Yeah.
As where, like, when my dad grew up back in, like, the 40s mm-hmm, or something, mm-hmm. he used to tell me, like, oh, we went to the cinema and we saw three movies that night.
Yeah.
And we saw three movies that night.
Yeah, and my grandma told me they watch movies in the cinema almost every night.
So I don't think it's fair for theater owners and chains to complain that people don't go to the cinema because they are outpricing the competition.
Mm.
Like, because when people have such easy access to good content now, which with Netflix and HBO Now and so on.
Yeah, and they have good TVs and good projectors at home.
Yeah, so you have, as a theater, you have to provide a superior experience at a cost that is accessible to people.
Mm.
And if you want people to come to this theater a lot, then lower your prices and people will come.
Yeah, yeah.
So
it's a must.
I think it would be great for the entire movie industry, particularly here in Sweden, if the cinema prices were like halved or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Because then people would really go to the movies.
Yeah.
I don't think...
You would go twice.
Exactly. And I mean, like, in other countries, like let's say Spain, I lived in Barcelona for 7 months.
Mm.
And there, the ticket prices are basically, like, usually it's like 5-6 euros for a ticket.
Mm, that's good.
To me, that's like really, really cheap. But then they also had, like, on Wednesdays, you could go for half price.
Okay.
So it's like 3 euros to watch a movie. But then the problem there is people still don't go, which to me is a bit strange. But maybe, like, like pirating is so big in Spain that it's still a problem, or people don't make, because they also have a big problem with unemployment and so on. For them, it, like, 6 euros might still be a lot of money to some people.
Yeah. So if you can get it for free, then you do.
Yeah, and I mean, here in Sweden, still quite a few people go to the movies, even though it costs a lot of money.
Hmm.
But I think more people would go if they made it cheaper.
Yeah. Where pirating go too far, where I don't even understand it, is when it comes to screeners. Why you want to see something somebody filmed in a cinema on your phone or computer, it's just beyond me, because it's just such a subpar experience.
Yeah, no, and I'm also very much about the movie experience. But I think you can have a pretty great movie experience at home with a big television, great sound system and so on.
As long as the file you have or whatever is good.
But no, I don't understand. I mean, I almost don't understand the movie company sending out Oscar screeners on DVDs to people. Because, like, you want to watch the movies if you're going to vote for the films. But I'm about the quality and so on also. I don't want to watch a blurry movie. In DVD quality, because that's where we are now. People have such great equipment at home that they can watch a 4K movie or whatever. And that's what the theaters are competing against.
Mm.
And they have to understand that they are competing. And then they wanna compete by just the time spans and saying no one else is gonna be allowed to watch these movies outside of the theater before maybe like a month or two. But that's not the reality we're living in.
No.
But because of piracy and because of the international, because of social networks and the world becoming smaller through that, I think movies have to be released simultaneously internationally now. And to me, it would be great if they were released in cinemas and on VOD almost at the same time, so people can choose.
And some movies are.
Yeah, and some movies are, and I think that's really good.
Yeah, we have some strange situations going on now with the latest Cloverfield movie that just was released on Netflix instead of in the cinemas, and they released the trailer just 2 hours before, basically, the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
Very strange.
Yeah, it was an interesting marketing move by Netflix, honestly. And I haven't seen the movie yet, have you?
Yeah.
What do you think?
I was talking about this with a friend the other day, and we both are sci-fi fans, and so we were like, maybe not a great film, but since it's us, we like it anyway, because it's set in a space station, and it's mysterious, so it's going to be great for us just because it's that.
Mm-hmm.
We just feel alien and whatever when we see it, like, okay, this is good. Mm-hmm. So that kind of type of production makes it everything better. So I might be the wrong person to ask.
Yeah, no, because the talk in filmmaker circles and so on was basically that Paramount sold the rights to, like, they dumped the movie on Netflix because they didn't have faith in it.
No, they didn't.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a smart marketing move by Netflix, but also I'm hearing more and more complaints about the quality control at Netflix. Basically, that they like, if you are a small someone posted about this on Twitter a while ago. Like, if you're a small indie filmmaker, it's really hard to get Netflix to pick up your movie. Mm. But if you're a big studio, you can sell any shit movie to Netflix, yeah, and they're just gonna like publish it.
And
that's interesting. Yeah. But then at the other end of the spectrum, basically, you have movies like Annihilation.
Yeah, I was just going to mention. Alice Garland. Yeah. Which seems to be an amazing film.
I haven't seen it yet, but like I'm a huge fan of Ex Machina and Alex Garland in general. Mm. And what I've heard so far is that Annihilation is a great movie.
Yeah.
And Paramount releasing that, or like, they are going to release it in cinemas in the United States.
They have.
And some other markets, but at least in Europe. It's going to be on Netflix, which, I mean, to me, it's
really, I think the rest of the world, basically. Yeah.
And I would have loved to see it at the cinema.
Yeah, but me too.
At the same time, I'm kind of happy that it's going to be on Netflix. Because, like, I want to see the movie.
You can see it soon.
and I can see it soon, and I have a big television. So I still, like, for me, I still get a great, great experience. I don't think the experience, like, watching something at home, where I can pause the movie if I want to, where I can play it loud because I like loud movies. Because like sometimes when I go to the cinema, I have like I've gone and complained to the theater, like, I'm paying you good money. Why are you not cranking up the sound on the movie?
Huh? Okay.
Because like I want a great experience, and most of the time I don't get that in the cinema.
Yeah.
So then what am I paying for?
Yeah. Really? As long as it's not above the legal threshold.
It shouldn't be too loud. But honestly, I mean, I've gotten answers from theater chains about like, let's say I asked, why is the sound not loud? And they're like, oh yeah, it's because there are not that many people in the cinema, so we lower the volume. And I'm like, why? And then I've complained.
Because we're dampening the sound with our bodies, something like that.
Yeah, maybe. And then also questions about like, why is the 3D not sharp? And they're like, well, yeah, we should really have two projectors in this room, but we're cheap, so we have one. And then like, what am I paying
for here? Exactly. What am I paying for here? Because it's the same price in a small, crummy multiplex as it is in not IMAX, but on a big screen.
Yeah.
So it's very strange.
Yeah.
They should actually adjust the price according to what kind of venue you're in.
Yeah, I've been saying that for a long time. And I think I even like emailed the biggest theater chain in Sweden about that. Saying that you should like have your full price for the big rooms and then lower the price accordingly for the smaller cinema screens.
Yeah, makes sense.
But yeah, I mean, it makes sense to us as consumers, but it doesn't make sense to a big corporation.
No.
Because like they make the same amount of money if they charge double the price and have like half the people, right? So yeah, so it's economics, basically.
Well, we should wrap this up. So we can see Origins on all those platforms you mentioned, and where do we find you otherwise? Do you have social media that you want to plug, stuff like that?
Yeah, I'm on Facebook and also on Twitter. I'm at Andreas Clement with a C, and also, I mean, just Google me, and I'm there on the internet.
Yeah, yeah, around the interwebs.
Yeah,
yeah. All right, and let's hope you get that next feature going soon.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Looking forward to seeing. Oh yeah, some interesting information for you budding filmmakers out there. Next episode will be out in 2 weeks' time, and until then, just make your short film.